Man, I saw a movie a few weeks ago I want to talk about.
What movie was that?
It was The Banker, the first theatrical premiere from Apple TV Plus. I saw it in theaters back when it was semi-safe.
Back when you were allowed in a theater.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't safe, but it was literally the only person there. So there was one other couple there, and then me and two friends. But yeah, it was all by happenstance. I mean, I mentioned in the podcast that I might like try to seek it out on a road trip I would already be on, but that there were no showings near me. And by way of school canceling, and I was already in Florida for a rocket launch that weekend. I spent a couple of extra days in Florida to see some family. And I looked, and the day that I arrived to visit family, I saw The Banker was playing in 2 hours, and I told my uncle, you want to go? And my brother came with me, and it was at an IPIC theater. There was one other couple there, and they weren't friendly because we were like, you know, private viewing and everything. Like, but I wanted to ask him, like, you know, what brings you out, you know, and see if they knew about the Apple connection, but they didn't want to talk. but I found the movie to be very good. And then when I left the theater, it closed, and, you know, for the foreseeable future, like after that movie ended. And of course now it's on Apple TV Plus. So people have already seen it that way. And you can see it that way if you'd like. But I thought
if you'd have walked into the theater, mm-hmm. would you have known it was any related to Apple at all?
I suspect that couple that was there was an older couple, that they came because of the actors in the movie.
Yeah.
And not because it was an Apple movie.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. But if you watch the film,
mm-hmm.
do you get told it's an Apple film?
So, I told my uncle that I was watching for that, because I told him the whole backstory of it being delayed from last fall or winter and, you know, all the backstory there, and that it's Apple's first theatrical release, and they have this in select theaters so that they can be eligible for awards later on, and that it's like Apple bought the movie, and you know, they had it made, and it will be on their service, but for now it's only in select theaters, and we're in one of those lucky theaters. And then I told him I was watching for anything in the opening scene or the after credits to let you know this is from Apple, and the trailers played. And then the trailers ended, and then there was an Apple logo, not just like, my guess was you'd see an Apple original, like flat on screen before, mm-hmm. but there was an Apple logo, like animation. And then after that, there was an
Apple. Different to like the Apple TV Plus thing that happens when you watch a show at home.
Mm-hmm. And then there was an Apple original animation, not just like flat white text on a black background, but like an animation. And my uncle said, go Apple in the theater. So I don't know what that was about, but no, it was funny. But there was, I mean, you would not have missed the Apple. It was on two different slides, you know, the logo and then an Apple original. And then when the movie came out on Apple TV Plus, I watched the beginning of it there to see how that looked. And the Apple logo wasn't there. It was just the Apple original thing that you always see. It wasn't even the same like version of it. So they've got one for theaters and one for streaming, I guess.
Yeah, because obviously like, the theatrical release is primarily there for awards eligibility, assuming awards ceremonies go ahead this year, which is up for debate in the current situation. But still, I'm sure there are people that would see the film, and then it almost acts as a bit of like marketing for the service as well, right? Like, oh, Apple's making a film, we're going to find it later and stuff. So
yeah,
it's pretty interesting, because the way these things work is that like The Banker was, the film was basically finished before Apple bought it. So
yeah,
I wasn't sure if they were going to have whatever. Because even just things like how credits are laid out on a movie poster, is there's so much legalese, and like some people's names have to be certain size. There's so much backstory to all of that stuff. I was just interested to see if Apple would actually have rights to have their name on the actual theatrical release at all. And clearly they do. And I think you'll see them do this even bigger ways going forward, because this film was only ever going to be in, you know, a relatively small number of theaters in America, even before it had to all be cancelled because of the coronavirus situation. But going forward, I think they are planning to do films that, you know, are like blockbuster releases that have widespread releases in America and internationally as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's such a quality of movie that it like totally makes sense to be in theaters. Like, I think I enjoyed it better in a theater environment than I would at home. The story's good, so there's no reason not to watch it at home. But I was glad I got the opportunity to see it in theaters. I waited after the movie to see if in the credits it mentioned Apple at all, and I didn't see any references. Maybe I missed it, but they definitely didn't have like their own slide screen for it. so everyone was gone but me. I was just like sitting there watching everything until the lights came back on. But you didn't see anything about Apple TV Plus, not even like the watch on Apple TV icon. And you could see them doing that in the future. But you mentioned this would have been in select theaters before it got delayed. That was once Apple bought it, but do you know if it wasn't an Apple TV movie, if it would have been in theaters or if it would have been widespread?
It depends who bought it, basically.
True, yeah.
I think it debuted at Sundance last year, and then it had like a distribution battle, and obviously whoever buys it then gets to choose how they want to show it in certain places.
Yeah. So yeah.
If someone else had bought it, maybe like if Netflix had bought it, then it might have just gone straight to streaming, apart from the small release to get awards eligibility. Or Universal had bought it, then it would get wider appeal. But generally, most Sundance films that end up on streaming services don't get the full blockbuster stuff. I don't really understand why, but they don't. And that's actually something Apple's doing at the moment, along with Netflix and Hulu and stuff, because the South by Southwest Festival cancelled. There's a load of films that like made by smaller companies, like indie style movies, that haven't been shown anywhere yet, because obviously Super was cancelled, and now there's a big like bidding war from all of these streaming services who are trying to get rights to these things that they can then call originals, because no one's actually shown it yet.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of ongoing at the moment, and the coronavirus obviously has massive effects to the world, but in the era of entertainment, it's also having problems with production not happening.
Yes.
Apple was particularly exposed because they didn't have much in development anyway, right? So anytime, even if they have 10% of their line, we're gone, that's a lot of their total arrangement. I'm sure they're all having the same kind of problems, but at least Netflix, if they're working on 100 shows and they've had to pause development on 20 of them, they probably still have enough pipeline for a while. But I think Apple was very clearly heading to want to have stuff like The Morning Show and For More Mankind premiere later this year, around the time when the 3-year subscriptions renew, right? The first lot of subscriptions renew. And the current state of the productions, it doesn't seem like they're going to be able to hit that. Or maybe they'll only be able to release like half a series at that time, because I think The Morning Show was like halfway through and the others were in different stages. But if this continued lockdown situation goes on for much longer, we're going to be months and months behind, and it's very clear to see that production on Apple's premier shows will easily slip into next year. I think the only one that's actually done to the point where they're on post-production is Dickinson, because Dickinson's always been ahead of the curve. They basically started shooting season 2 like in October, so they've always been on the edge. They've like finished, but the other like premier productions, especially like The Morning Show stuff, which is the one that got the awards, it's going to be interesting how that ends up being rolled out, because I think their original plan has been scuppered.
Yep. The only thing I had to tell my brother and uncle was, it's a Samuel L. Jackson movie. And they're like, well, it can't be bad then. So,
And I want to watch it. Although now, unfortunately, in Europe at least, the quality of all streaming services is being limited just to ease network strain while everyone's at home.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, Apple service seems to be affected more intensely than the others. Like however Apple's responding to the request from the EU, they've like really ramped down the quality. So like The Banker, when I played like a minute clip of it for the story I did on this, it was like sub 720p quality. So it's like so is so in the current world.
There's movie theater quality and there's sub 480p quality.
Yeah, it's almost like the quality, it was almost like blocky to the point where it was like you were streaming over like a 3G network or something.
It'd probably look good on like an iPod Nano or something.
Yeah, it was like the iPod, get the older iPod video on that two inch square screen. I'm sure it looks great on that.
Yeah, 240p is awesome if you're on the right device. Let's talk about some iPhone stuff. So in the lineup this week, we have iPhone 9 Plus to discuss, and again with iPhone 9 we have no idea what the name is, but the idea here is that we do know what the body will look like, what the chip will be, A13, what the sort of pricing angle will be in a certain range at least, how it's positioned as an iPhone lineup, but we don't know the name of it. But one thing we did not know before, because it really wasn't rumored, is that there would be the iPhone 8 replacement and now an iPhone 8 Plus replacement, which in retrospect, like, makes perfect sense. But just the fact that it hadn't been in supply chain rumors, for example, or any reports, we didn't talk about it. And a couple of weeks ago, 95 Mac found evidence in iOS 14 code that not just the iPhone 8 replacement size phone will come, but the iPhone 8 Plus size phone will come, right?
Yeah. So Quo had a story in the last year-ish that there would be a kind of SE Plus phone, but it wasn't scheduled until 2021. So he was going on the basis that there would be, you know, the SE 2, iPhone 9, whatever you want to call it, in the spring, like now time, and then next year Apple would follow up with a 5.5-inch sized one as well. And so there's a chance that this could just be referring to that, but it's early. But I actually agree with you. Like, it kind of makes sense for them to do both, because we have to presume that when they release this new cheaper model, which we think is going to be priced about $400, which is $50 less than the iPhone 8, but this phone looks exactly like an iPhone 8 and it's slightly better. So you have to expect that the iPhone 8 line goes away,
yeah,
and this comes in instead. And right now they sell both the iPhone 8 and the iPhone 8 Plus, and surely they're not going to have a situation where they just keep selling the 8 Plus on its own and then have the, you know, the SE 2 below that. So having the two screen sizes, probably perfectly fine. And, you know, the market at the moment likes big screens, right? Like, uh-huh. It doesn't matter if you're buying a cheap phone or not. People tend to, you know, be drawn to big screens. The classic SE, the original SE, obviously has that factor of only being a 4-inch phone. But I think everything we've seen has shown that Apple doesn't really care about that. And, mm-hmm. you know, they're moving up to 4.7 and they're moving up to 5.5. So I don't think there's much motivation from our perspective to be like, you know, we need to keep a small phone around. They're happy to just go for the price play and go for the market share. And mm-hmm. you can imagine that, you know, a cheaper iPhone will do pretty well at the moment, right? Like, sure. it will do pretty well generally and pretty well at the moment. Like, people have to refresh their phones, you know, even if upgrade demand is low. When your phone breaks, you know, you still have to buy a new one, even if you're stuck at home, right? And so the fact that and you're probably less likely to go for one that's more expensive because people are saving money. And it's almost a good time for this kind of entry to come out.
Yeah, I was on a different podcast a few hours ago, and I was asked if what is our take on when this will come out? And something I mentioned maybe here before, but elsewhere, is that, you know, right now, we totally talked about this, but it's touchy to release expensive new things like, oh my gosh, you know, the Mac Pro right now, we're learning the price of the display and the stand would be wild right now, and seems so out of touch. But, you know, Apple is a business and they do sell products that service people or that they rely on. And anytime they can have a product like Power Beats, the new Power Beats that replace something older and inferior, but for a lower price now, is a positive story. And that would be the case for this iPhone. You know, it will be a faster phone, a more capable phone than the iPhone 8 that it will presumably replace. So, you know, you didn't quite get that story with the iPads, I guess, you know, and definitely not with the keyboard stand and the Magic Keyboard accessory. But
they didn't raise the price, right? And they doubled the base storage, and you did
that's true
the features,
you know, and you definitely got that story with the MacBook Air. I mean, man, it's a good value. It's got a good keyboard and it's got a good price now. And then Mac Mini went down the line with his prices and storage rates. But this fits into that, you know, totally a cool launch. And like in the fall, like whatever the situation is with the world, you know, as long as Apple doesn't raise the price on the phones, then, you know, it's good for the company and it's good for users. So,
like obviously they can't, you know, the products in development for this year are basically already set, right? And so mm-hmm. the roadmap is there and they're a business. They can't hold these products forever. Like the current coronavirus situation could be going on for a year, and then the economic repercussions of that could be going on for 3 years. Like, we don't really know yet exactly how bad it's going to turn out. So saying like, oh, they just hold this stuff forever is just kind of unrealistic. But when they do have products that line up well, there's good optics there, and they definitely like take advantage of that kind of thing where they can.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's helped by the fact that they've done donations. So like, for example, Apple's donated up to 10 million of the N95 masks just so far by sourcing from their production lines, I suppose. And they've done different amounts in Italy and playing to another country. So that's all that helps a lot. And also the fact is there's a lot of people or at least a number of people who use the iPhone 6 or 6 Plus who can't run iOS 13, or use the 6S or 6S Plus or the 7 or 7 Plus. And, you know, the upgrade path would be from those phones, you know, one of those other phones, or the 8 and 8 Plus, and the 8 and 8 Plus are as old as the iPhone 10, you know, which is two generations ago. So it's a smart, positive move to do this as soon as possible. And, you know, it kind of reminds me when they did the iPad Air, was it 3, where they put a mid-level product in the market. Yeah. You know, it's kind of like that. Cause these have never been like low-end phones or cheap phones, but they,
We talk about it being like the cheap iPhone, but that's relative to iPhone prices.
It's like you've got the $329 iPad, and there's not really an iPhone equivalent to that. Because you compare it $329, like maybe it's similar to the price of the phone, but if you compare it to the fact that you know, phones or iPads can cost over $1,000, you know, iPhones can too, but most of them, you know, you get for $700.
I guess you look at the Android phone space, and you can find very competitive phones that are cheaper than $399, right? Like, whereas you look at the tablet side of the equation, and you know, for the tablet competition that does exist, you really can't find anything close to what the iPad offers for $329.
No,
like,
yeah,
that's where it comes in. Like the older Pixels, for instance, are really good. You know, Android, they're perfectly fine Android phones that you can find very, very cheaply, and the iPhone's still going to be more premium than that, right? And in a way has a slightly worse visual design and not as nice and stuff. So, you know, like there's nothing wrong with the iPhone SE 2 existing and being there, but we always have to qualify that when we're saying cheap iPhone, it's cheap to the iPhone, not cheap to like the smartphone market. Whereas I would say the iPad is like a cheap tablet. Like
more affordable tablet. Yeah. They still didn't hit like the.
Yeah. I mean, you can get like, I guess it's a cheap tablet for what it is, right? Like obviously you can get the $199 tablets in places.
It's an affordable and highly capable tablet.
Yeah, like the $199 tablets, you're not going to find a $200 tablet that has the same screen quality, the same feature set, the same accessories and design, and be, you know, it's like everything's, the iPad space is just continues to be incredibly dominant by, you know, Apple and basically nobody else, like no tablet competition, whereas obviously the phone market's very different.
Yeah my brother is someone who does purchase like the, you know, as affordable as possible phones. And so right now he uses an Android phone that has a fingerprint sensor in the back. And, you know, so it's like the equivalent of a 5S, you know, essentially, in terms of that feature at least. And I think he paid like $60 for it. And it's because it's like one of the carrier locked, prepaid phones. And the equivalent on the iPhone would be, I think, an iPhone 6 for $99, you know, and that doesn't support the current software. Then you got a $200, you can get a 6S that way, and it's locked to that carrier. So it's, you know, not just device price either.
Yeah, and Apple doesn't want to keep promoting phones that can't get the latest version of the operating system, that can't take advantage of things like Apple Arcade and, you know, all of that stuff. It's, and all the augmented reality efforts are all wasted on those lower end phones. So there's definitely a reason for this to exist and to have like to be an iPhone 8 with an A13 chip inside it.
Yep. The only thing they'll sell that can't be supported in the software is the iPod Touch. And I'm looking at you remember when they sold that and you couldn't even run the current software? They're on.
Oh, yeah. That was
bad.
Painful for a while.
Yeah. They're on. Yeah. They're all six generations now. So I guess that's current, right?
Yeah. They did refresh them last year, right?
So they don't
obviously when they refresh it last year, they just gave it a chip update, and I think it was A10 or something. But it was whatever the requirement was to support AR stuff and group FaceTime.
Yeah,
but the design is still like 8 years old.
Is which one's July 2015? Because that's what they sell now in the refurbished store.
No, that's the one before the current. That's the one before the current one. So the current one was last year.
Oh, and they still sell. They sell the A8 chip with for refurbished prices, so that's the one that can't run the current software, right?
Yeah, that's the one that can't run the current software. Yeah.
Well, you can buy it in every color. It's too bad. There's not much of a discount either. It's $150.
$150, really? Is that much to sell for refurbished? Because you can get the new ones for $199.
Yeah, it's $150 or $219 if you do the storage upgrade to $128.
Well, what a bargain.
Yeah. I mean, it has Passbook on the home screen.
Yeah.
In Game Center, like, and videos.
The iPod Touch is not what I would call value for money, unfortunately. Like, yeah. It exists for people that want it, but it's $199 for a product that isn't great.
Really, yeah, I used them with the kids before. My daughter got an iPhone. My son still has one, you know, so... the one that we bought for my daughter went to a family friend.
Yeah, like my sister has an iPod Touch and an iPad, and it was her birthday a few weeks ago, and the family was like, you know, asking me, like, should we upgrade our iPod and upgrade our iPad? I was like, well, technically there are new versions of both, but you don't want to upgrade the iPod Touch because she had the 2015 one, and the jump to the next one is not that great, whereas upgrading from like an iPad Air to the new 7th generation iPad is like a complete sea change, and it's so much better value. We are sponsored this week by Pillow. Now, getting a good night's sleep is underrated, but with a little help, it can be life-changing. Pillow is an all-in-one sleep tracking solution to help you be more aware of your sleep patterns and discover what might be affecting your sleep quality. If you have an Apple Watch, tracking your sleep is as easy as wearing it to bed. Pillow will track and analyze your sleep patterns automatically. One of Pillow's most loved features is the ability to get a detailed heart rate diagram of every sleep session. You can compare your sleep quality with your weight, steps, caffeine consumption, and many other health metrics to discover how they might be affecting how you sleep. You can enable the recording mode, and Pillow will save the sounds that you make during nighttime, from sleep talking to sleep apnea, snoring, any other unexpected noises that might be affecting your sleep. You can see them, and a lot of users have been surprised by the results. Pillow is very privacy-minded. All your sleep and audio data is encrypted and stored on your device and on your iCloud storage using end-to-end encryption. Pillow doesn't have user accounts, you can use it anonymously, and it doesn't collect or send your personal data anywhere else. Naps boost your focus, creativity, and overall well-being. If you're working from home, you can also take naps using Pillow's power nap modes. If you need an alarm, Pillow can wake you up using your iPhone, watch, iPad. If you have WatchOS 6 installed on your Apple Watch, the latest update of Pillow allows users to use the new extended runtime feature to minimize battery consumption on the watch. Pillow is available in the App Store for the iPhone, Apple Watch, and iPad. Discover all of Pillow's features at naybox.com/pillow. That's naybox.com/pillow. Sleep well and stay safe. Our thanks to Pillow for their support of Happy Hour.
Yep. So that's iPhone 9 for the week. There was an iPhone 12 story that came about too from Ming-Chi Kuo, right, about camera stuff.
Yeah. So he was talking a bit about the technical details of the cameras for this year. Apparently, the high-end 6.7-inch model, so quick refresher, we're expecting 4 iPhone flagships this year.
Of course.
They're all OLED. Yeah. One's 5.4, 2 are 6.1. And then there's a high-end 6.7, which is a bigger screen size than Apple's ever offered before on an iPhone, obviously, because the current one tops out at 6.5. Because of bezel changes, we don't expect that the actual physical size of the phone to be much different. Like, they're going to shrink the bezels a little bit and hopefully just squeeze out a bit more screen real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And then of those 4 phones, this one of the 6.1 inches and the 6.7 are like the equivalent of the Pro line, because they're the one that's going to have the time-of-flight camera. And according to Quo, they're also going to have higher specs as well. So, for instance, the top-end 6.7-inch model will have a new camera module for the wide-angle lens, which will have a 7-element lens, and it's going up to a 1 over 1.9-inch aperture, which is up from 1 over 3.6. So that's just more light coming in, so that results in better quality photos. And it will also have sensor shifting, which is a different type of image stabilization. So that's all great, right? Like, top-end cameras get better specs. What was most interesting to me in this report is that it says in 2022, so we are going a bit further out here. So,
like, as we do.
This year it'll be the same camera module, you know, with a slight spec bump, similar upgrades for 2021. And then 2022, that phone will apparently switch to a periscope design camera, which is something we've discussed on the podcast before, and something that some Android phones already do, where rather than having the lenses like horizontal inside the body, they kind of refract with this mirror system. So what you see on the top of the lens isn't really the lens. It kind of reflects down this mirror that goes further down, and basically it results in higher quality photos with the ability to have more zoom, and you don't have to have as much of a camera bump because the bump's like inside the phone, not, you know, not pushing directly up the top. And so that's something Apple's apparently considering and working on for, you know, down the road, but that's still 2 years away. But that's cool because periscope cameras seem pretty cool.
Yeah, I agree. It just sounds cool. It sounds better. I haven't thought a whole lot about the fall 2020 iPhone lineup, but I would definitely be willing to go for a bigger phone. I've adapted to the size I have now, and same thing with iPad. If they ever do a bigger iPad than 12.9 inch, I'd be happy with that too.
I do have questions about the appeal of this phone because, yes, there's the 5G thing, right? Okay,
yeah,
so, right. But then they're going to have the time of flight sensor, which we now know as the LiDAR scanner, which, you know, we've kind of seen from the iPad reviews this week, doesn't do much. Fair enough. It doesn't seem particularly overwhelming.
It's
or like,
only about AR right now. And my take on that is that with AR, I do try some different AR apps with the kids, and most recently one that I used just myself. When I used to play Pokemon Go, I would never use AR because, especially when they added the AR kit stuff, you had to find a flat surface, and that was hard without, like, you know, seeking one out. And the LiDAR stuff is like you get to do AR without that step. You know, you just get right to it if it works as I believe it does.
Yeah.
And so that's compelling to me. It's like, to me, it's like this is AR kit finally that you can use without frustrations.
I mean, it was clever that they could do all the stuff they could do before just using normal cameras, and you didn't need fancy sensors, but you can see how with the sensor in place now that you don't have to worry about, you know, spinning your phone around the room and getting it to be ready, and even without that, just the accuracy of the scene detection is much better.
Yeah but it is very, I think it's very niche, and it's
yeah, but then it's like, okay, so the AR is better, but what AR are you doing? That's the problem.
Yeah, you know? right yeah. So, and it'll just be better for AR whenever it's on every phone anyway.
Yeah, I'm really hoping this year's phones add like 120 hertz or something, you know, like high ProMotion screen refresh rate.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's pretty common on Android phones now, including on OLED phones.
Yeah, in past years, you'd make the point that it was not, and so now it is.
Yeah, like it kind of got popular, I'd say, in the middle of last year. So it was the kind of thing that, you know, maybe would have been on the 11 Pro, but we didn't expect it, right? Because Apple's generally slow on that kind of stuff on for the most part, but this year it kind of feels more like standard. Not for the cheaper line of the phones, but for the high end models. If they have another year of only being 60 hertz, it'd be a bit sad.
Yeah, and I don't track that so closely, but is that something that Samsung phones have now, like the Galaxy S20?
Yeah, it does. Yeah,
yeah. Okay,
so it's Samsung goes to 120 hertz for sure.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
But we haven't heard any rumors about Apple doing it, sadly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am more interested than other people about 5G. Just because it's time.
We've obviously had this chat so many times on the show already.
But yeah.
For me, it's like the LiDAR scanner is 5G. It's like, okay, so you got 5G and you can download stuff faster, but what are you going to do with it, really?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they'll have something really clever that they're like, oh, now you've got all this bandwidth, you can do this really cool thing. But maybe it'll be like the iPad Pro with LiDAR is like, here's LiDAR scanner and maybe
you can do group FaceTime without people loading. And like, I often get on a FaceTime call, low connection where it blurs everything for a little bit. And, it's like those things. And I was walking around a couple of weeks ago. I was in a grocery store and I saw people using FaceTime like to show things that they were shopping for and like getting their people's opinion on those. And I was like, that's neat. You know, when the iPhone 4 came out with FaceTime, you couldn't do that. and then you could do it on the 4S.
They didn't do it on cellular until the iPhone 5 with 4G.
Okay. Yeah. So for two phones, you couldn't do that. Be not at home and use FaceTime. And they used, like you said, 4G for the reason for that, even if it was capable otherwise. So maybe there'll be that kind of benefit too, because that's a big deal. Like, you be able to do FaceTime away from home and or not to. And now it's trivial. Like, you'd never imagine that you never could do that. So for that reason, I'm excited about 5G. And
we have heard some rumors this week about like you know, Apple might be delaying it because of the situation, mm-hmm. or, you know, maybe the 5G models won't be ready. Like, I you know, I have no supply chain insight on this stuff, but I would be absolutely flabbergasted if they do not have a 5G phone out this year.
After, like, after the deal with Qualcomm, like, they spent money on that.
they gave up money. Yeah. They didn't like, you know, make a deal with the devil, to put it in such words. At the last minute, they didn't hire the entire Intel acquisition, right? That $1 billion acquisition. They didn't do all that to, like, not do it. And yeah, there are supposedly, quote says, all four of these phones support 5G. And maybe the delays in the supply chain at the moment and the disruption will make it so that, you know, they can only get two models out on time, or it will be October rather than September. But, like, there's no way they're not going to have at least a high-end 5G iPhone out for the Christmas period. It just seems impossible.
Yeah, and I always think about the people who are not like us that upgrade every year, or I guess you do every other year or so, but the more common upgrade path where you upgrade every other year or every 3 years, you know, unless you do an upgrade program, that if you buy your phone now and 5G isn't so much on your radar, but then you use it for 3 years, then in that second and third year, maybe you will appreciate it, even if you don't have 5G in your area now. Because the rollout is not slow. It's happening. Let's see. So that's iPhone 12. Let's talk about some stories we've had over the last couple of weeks that have been exclusive because of the iOS 14 code that we've got. First thing is about Maps and CarPlay. And I'll hit the CarPlay part because it's so minor but exciting to me as a CarPlay user. We've discovered in iOS 14, this build that we have from December, of support for wallpapers in CarPlay. And I don't know if we know if they're custom or not, but at least, like, the stock ones that you see on the iPhone 11 Pro, they've got those,
like, lava lamp pictures.
Exactly. And they've got a light mode and a dark mode. And this year with CarPlay on iOS 13, we got light mode for CarPlay because it's always been dark mode. And now that they've got, you know, more light and dark mode throughout the Apple's systems, they brought light mode to CarPlay. I think it's not on by default, but you can turn it on. And these wallpapers, just like on the iPhone, will change with which mode you're using. And it's neat. Like, it's kind of like the iPhone 4 moment where you got to use wallpapers for the first time, or iOS 4, I suppose. It's subtle, but it makes a big difference. And I'm not sure if you'll be able to do custom ones or not. It sounds kind of wild that you'd be able to do custom, but it gives CarPlay a fresh look to have some background there, not just the blank screen.
Some people might be like, why would they not let you set a custom wallpaper? There's complicated, like, legal stuff behind what they're allowed to show on a CarPlay UI.
Yeah.
Like, to get approval to be able to be, like, used hands-free and stuff, they're not allowed to show, like, arbitrary UI. That's why they don't have a CarPlay SDK for developers, which is, like, you can just do whatever you want.
Make Twitterific for CarPlay.
Netflix. All the apps are, like, stripped down to very strict templates, and for the longest time they had the, you know, you had to get the entitlement for Apple to even be part of the thing, and they've loosened it up slightly, but it's still very, very rigid, and I'm pretty sure all of that's just backed by, they have to comply with legal requirements of, and not just, like, you know, legal requirements in the US, legal requirements around the world about exactly what they're allowed to do. So
yeah,
and maybe they can get a sign off on these wallpapers, but they're not, you know, not necessarily going to let you just pick any picture that you choose.
Yeah. And I mean, Felipe Esposito for 905 Mac and ihelp.br, he made mockups of how this will look in a car. And it's just like a wallpaper on your phone. It's refreshing to see this. So I think it's, you know, looking forward to that. I have tried for the first time one of those adapters in the car to make a wireless CarPlay, and it's one of those things from Amazon. I'll see if I can find and link it in the podcast, but it worked. I was so amazed. And what you do is you add the adapter to your car like it's a phone, and, you know, so you get, like, so many phones per car, and you have to delete additional ones as you go. And so I had to make room for it, and then you connect your phone to it, and there's, like, one time setup, and then from there on you just get in the car and it works every time. And it's really smooth, and it's so neat now to have wireless CarPlay that I've, you know, my wife's car has had for their aftermarket display, but my built-in CarPlay screen did not have wireless CarPlay. And now I will go, like, down the street, as much as I'm not driving very much right now, but as much as I can, and phone's in my pocket, and I'll never take it out, and CarPlay starts, and it's, I forget that it's even going to happen because I'm not used to it yet, you know. So,
do you know how much was it roughly?
It was under $200. It's probably about $150.
Okay.
We'll see if we can find out right now while you tell us about some other maps features.
Yeah, 150 is not terrible.
I mean, a different screen would be 500 plus,
yeah,
probably.
Yeah, 500 to 1,000, sure.
Yeah, and in my car, I couldn't change the screen because it's integrated with the system too much. It's CarLink Kit 2.0 from, I guess, the maker is CarLink Kit. And I had purchased one before, and they canceled the order because they weren't sure if it would be compatible. So it comes down to the car maker and model. I guess they have different versions. But this was... I paid $149 for it, and right now it's $125, and you can save $15 and get the coupon applied to that.
That's not too bad.
Yeah, so it's more in the, which maybe is what I paid for it too. But yep, maybe I paid $150 because I'm looking at my order, isn't it? No, it shows $129. Yeah, cool. So less than that. That's pretty good. And it's really cool. What's new in Apple Maps that's kind of being worked on with iOS 14 code?
Yeah, so already if you go into, like, if you click on Apple Store on an iOS 13 device, it will show you, like, today Apple sessions, and it'll give you a little preview of what's there. It sounds like they're going to build on that kind of stuff in a bigger way with 14. You'll be able to get, like, Genius Bar availability directly in the Maps app, so you wouldn't have to go to the Apple Store app and see the appointments. You'd be able to do it inside of Maps. It could tell you whether, for instance, a particular store has screen and battery repairs for same day service. So you'd know that you could just go straight there and get it repaired on the same day without having to send it off or come back overnight. It could even show you opportunities for device trade-ins directly. So kind of like, you know, Maps upsell features. But I think it's fine. Like if it's on the Apple Store card, you know, you're probably interested in the Apple Store. So that's, I think, adding that kind of like metadata and additional help is, you know, perfectly fine. I wouldn't call it advertising. I'd just call that being helpful, yeah. Right? Like if they started showing that, you know, on the home screen, then obviously that's a bit of an overreach. But if you're looking at an Apple Store, I'd love to see that kind of information. And at the moment, it seems kind of limited to Apple Stores and maybe some Apple authorized service providers. But it would also kind of be nice, and this is going beyond the code, if they could offer those kind of advanced like integrations with just random shops. Like, they do it kind of for like some parking things where it integrates and says, there's parking spaces here, or there's Tesla parking here, or there's electric vehicle parking here. It'd be pretty cool if there was like a kind of third party API where just a random business could like register, you know, an app extension. And then when you clicked on their business in Maps, it could then just show anything related to that store. So Starbucks could show you deals and offers if you had the Starbucks app installed. That's just something I've thought of off the top of my head, but that'd actually be pretty cool. And then in addition to that, Apple Maps will also have some new indicators for like places that have special seating arrangements for couples or children discounts and private rooms. They'll also be doing better displaying visualizations of like movie theaters with IMAX available. And, you know, that probably is going to have some sort of Apple TV Plus integration. I'm sure at some point they'll have like, here's the movies that are playing directly in this cinema, and you can book them now, and they'll show the Apple TV Plus and stuff. But all that kind of stuff is just very useful. It reminds me a lot of, like, you know, when you do a search in Google and they show like the card information instead of just search results. That's kind of what they're trying to build out now for Maps for different types of businesses and services. And obviously they're starting with the Apple Store, but you can see it going much, much wider.
Yeah, it's very cool. And also location-based are some changes with Find My, which is the app that used to be Find My iPhone and Find My Friends, and they got mushed together as one in iOS 13. It's working out pretty well for me, at least. What's new are some new triggers for notifications. So it really interesting to me, and ones that I hadn't thought about, but I will definitely use. So for example, you'll be able to have an alert when someone arrive. Well, right now you can have an alert if someone arrives somewhere, when they arrive at a location or at a certain time, and or when they leave there. But you can't have an alert if they don't arrive. And my example of this is that I don't do this, but if I did, I could have an alert when my daughter arrives at school. But then it would be an alert every day she goes to school. and you know, you kind of get used to it and you just ignore it. Instead, what's useful is this feature in iOS 14 where you can receive an alert only if she doesn't arrive at school, which is what I'd care about. You know, ideally things go smooth, no alert, but in this case, if she doesn't make it for some reason, then I'm notified about it. And the same thing, you can, as a person, you can set up the same thing, but you know, you make the alert for yourself for someone else to receive. So this is really interesting to me, and I will definitely use this. So, it's neat.
Yeah. Cause not only does it like reduce the notification spam, it's also a nice way of conveying the information that someone cares about without like spying on them too much. Right. Mm-hmm. Because it's like, you know, you got to work fine, but if you don't get to work, that's actually what you're caring about really, isn't it? It's like you haven't got there. That's where you have a problem. So mm-hmm. you can imagine like, how it can be set up so that even if you're not like directly sharing your exact location, you can just send the alert. It's like, you know, let my spouse know that I didn't arrive at work today, and then she can follow up from there and maybe phone me or whatever without mm-hmm. you having to be like, I'll just see where I go every minute of every day, right? Because there are some people that don't want to be exposed in that way, and mm-hmm. being able to offer those levels of controls is a really nice like privacy way of still letting the core feature of making sure that people are getting to the right places, the school is another great example, mm-hmm. without like tracking their every move.
Yeah. And the other thing you can do with iOS 14, based on the code that we've searched, is you can have an alert if your contact leaves somewhere before set time. So the example of my daughter is, you know, she goes to school. I only get an alert if she doesn't make it. In this case, I would use like my wife, for example. If she leaves work before the usual time, I can be alerted about that, and then I know to clean up the house before she's home. So a couple of new ways to use that. And you can customize these, you know, based on location, based on times of day, and even based on times of or days of the week. So it's not, you know, every single time. It's pretty cool. And then there's some new AR mode stuff in here. So it's kind of vague with what this is about. But the idea is that there's at least code to support some sort of headset mode. And this could just be laying the groundwork for like an Apple headset in 2022 or whenever that's coming. That's probably what it is. But, you know, maybe it works with other headsets because it doesn't necessarily rule out other headsets.
I mean, that's Quo's like current most recent report on AR stuff, is that Apple is supposedly collaborating with third-party manufacturers
yeah.
to offer integration with headsets. Maybe it'll be kind of like it'll be like a made for iPhone program type deal, where you'll be able to get some integration with other headsets that work with the iPhone, and then obviously Apple's work on theirs for, you know, a few years down the road. What it sounds like we found here was the kind of the Find My trackers and the Apple AirTag stuff is mm-hmm. there's going to be we've reported on this last year, you know, probably a year ago now, we were talking about how there's going to be an AR mode in the Find My app, so that if you do have using ultra wideband, it can precisely locate where the object is in the room. You can hold up your phone and it will like place balloons or, you know, a big arrow saying it's directly here in the room, not just it's in the room. Like
not this big map of in this circumference of, you know, that circle.
Yeah. And this is saying that they're at least playing with it in the AR in a headset as well. So you could put the headset on and see that same thing and see the balloons overlaid in the augmented reality world as well.
Yeah. And I mean, of course, like you said, but presumably it'll work from the phone or the iPad. But if you have the headset, then it's, you know, hands-free, I suppose.
More immersive. Although, I don't know if I'd be putting a headset just to find where I've lost my keys. It, obviously, the convenience there is you just hold up your phone and it shows where it is.
Yeah. Unless you're already wearing the headset for other reasons. You know what? I want to have the ultra-wideband chip, AirPods.
Yeah,
that'd be great. If they can work in AirTags, and they can work in AirPods. And AirPods, I've been on this journey where I fell asleep with one in. My dog got it, chewed it up, got it replaced. And most recently, my son, when I was working in the office with the door closed, I had my AirPods out on the coffee table, and he had fun with them, and you know, probably put them in and played around with them. And only one returned to the case, and now I've got the other one that I didn't replace missing. So I tried doing things like play a sound through it, try to connect to it, you know, find my feature for it. And, you know, that's no good. I only got alerted whenever I put in the one that I know where it is, that it was found then. But having the ultra wideband in an AirPods would be so cool. Left and right, you just find exactly where they are if they're nearby without being paired to them. So
We are sponsored this week by Solver. Solver is a smart notepad with a built-in calculator, and 9to5Mac Happy Hour listeners can get 15% off with code 9to5Mac at checkout. Find the link in the show notes. Solver for Mac is a powerful hybrid between a calculator and a text editor, allowing you to make quick calculations using a notepad-like interface. Solver gives instant answers to any calculations that it finds in your text. Think of it as more convenient and powerful than a traditional calculator, but far more lightweight than a full spreadsheet application. Solver works great as a simple calculator replacement, but it can be much more powerful. I've used Solver for years. A few weeks back, in fact, I used it to estimate Apple TV Plus subscriber numbers, basic shopping list accounting. It just comes in handy constantly. I love it for the kind of calculations in which you're juggling more variables than you could keep in your head, but you don't need the complexity or the ceremony of setting up a full spreadsheet. The app comes with a set of natural language functions that make it easy to do common operations, working with dates, times, percentages, real-world currency conversions, and so much more. All of this functionality is wrapped up in a lightweight design that fits in perfectly on your Mac. With dark mode support, you can use headings, labels, and comments to organize your notes, and everything is saved automatically. Solver is used by tens of thousands of productive people every day, including me and many of my colleagues at 9to5Mac. Visit solver.app to learn more and enter code 9to5Mac for an exclusive 15% off discount. That's solver.app and use code 9to5Mac at checkout for 15% off. Our thanks to Solver for their support of Happy Hour. Or put them in the case, because Find My AirPods doesn't work if the case is, like, if the AirPods
do it all.
In the case and shut, right?
Yes, do it all. You can't play a sound when they're closed. So.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, the Find My integration for AirPods is almost misleading, because people see it and they're like, oh, it's great. If I lose it, I'll just be able to find it like I can with my phone. But obviously It doesn't have GPS and it doesn't have any of that stuff. And it only works when the buds themselves are out on the ground and you're in Bluetooth range. Like, it's a whole thing. Whereas if they could integrate a UWB chip, and if they could integrate the Find My network, so, you know, like the offline finding stuff that they did with iOS 13, if you could do that with AirPods, so anyone could pick up your AirPods and then it communicate over the Find My network and ping the actual owner, that'd be so much better. But They haven't done it so far.
Yeah, and the other thing that we've covered this week is from iOS 14 code. This part of it is based in iOS 13.4 beta code before iOS 13.4 came out this week. But we learned even more about this feature in 14, and it's the feature that is called Car Key. What we learned in 14 is that Apple is explicitly working with BMW for support, so it's coded in so far for BMW to be supported. And we did some digging around on this and even asked BMW about it. You know, hey, what can you say about this? We found evidence that you're working with Apple on this feature. And, they had a fun statement, which was, please understand that at this point, we cannot confirm your request nor give you any further details. We would like you to refer you to our press release. And the press release was really interesting because it was from last December, and it's about a standard called Digital Key. So Apple's feature is called Car Key. The standard is called Digital Key. Apple is included, which is something that you reported like 2 years ago. The way that they announce this and describe it is like, you know, use your phone or watch or tablet to unlock your car, to crank your car. And the thing that we know about from Apple's side is that you can share your virtual car key with AirDrop or messages. And people compared to this, you know, I called it a futuristic feature in the headline, and people complained about it futuristic because Teslas can do a version of this. The difference is that the way that you share your car key with Tesla is you share your account username and password. And so that's a little bit different than, giving your kid or your spouse your virtual car key without them having your Apple ID. And also it's a standard. So Tesla is custom for Teslas. This is a standard that partners, you know, it's not just BMW. That was another pushback, was like, oh, great, you know, who, I don't have a BMW. Other partners include GM, you know, Hyundai, Volkswagen. So lots of car makers will support this. Lots of companies, including Apple, are behind this. And there's already like a 2.0 and a 3.0 of this feature documented from the standard, at least. And the thing that seems likely to happen is that with phones that have the ultra wideband chip, or if you don't have an ultra wideband chip like previous to the iPhone 11, then you wave your phone near the door or the ignition, and that's how you initiate the feature.
So it's like NFC fallback.
Exactly. It's phone in hand or Apple Watch on wrist, and then like basically like tap contactless. But the better version is explicitly about improving the feature to work with ultra wideband. That's from the standard's own wording. To where you can use Bluetooth Low Energy in combination with ultra wideband. Like that's the chip Apple uses. That's what they're using for the standard to initiate just by it being in proximity. So your phone can be in your pocket, in your backpack, in your purse, and you can unlock your car and start your car. Just like my key fob does. Like, you know, it's not my phone, but it's my key fob in my pocket or my backpack. And that's how I open the door and start the car. No need to wave the phone. This would be that, but you don't need the phone. You don't need the fob. You need your phone or your watch or maybe your iPad. So, it's neat how we found a little bit of evidence about this in 13.4, then even more in 14. Someone else has even included like the UI for this from 13.4 that shows a BMW and some UI for it. So you can see that in the story as well. But it's something that has been documented before. Like we've even written stories about the feature, and only from the reference that BMW gave us did we really connect all the dots and say like, wow, this is a feature that's totally being worked on out in the open. And cars already support this, you know, 2020 models and 2021 models. And, you know, there's the UWB angle to it as well.
Yeah, unlike a lot of CarPlay initiatives or like GymKit, it feels like this is more like when they do announce this, there'll probably be cars coming out soon that actually support it.
Or already.
Already out, yeah.
Yeah, your car that already has this feature, now your phone can work with it. It's kind of like going from a physical car key to a remote to having no car key and having to turn the car key to having a push to start ignition. It's just like competitive industry basic features. And because it's a standard, you know, there's no reason not to support it. You don't have to wait a long time. It's going to be like the next iteration of a car key. But it's your phone or your watch, which is really cool. And then there's the UWB stuff, which is like, oh, more reason to have that ultra wideband chip that so far is kind of pointless unless you love a very specific version of AirDrop.
Yeah, I've never used that since it came out.
I've tried it. I've still not been convinced I'm doing it right or benefited from it. And you had pointed out, I didn't mention the story, but you'd pointed out that there were references from Apple before about the possibility in the future of using the UWB chip for your car, right?
Yeah. So at the iPhone 11 event, when the press were getting their little briefings about, you know, the new features of the phone and here's your review unit and here's what you should test, obviously a lot of people were intrigued about the U1 chip because it was a new chip that Apple acknowledged on its website, but they didn't talk about it in the keynote, that it was just on a slide, right? And the running speculation is that Apple wanted to have the AirTags out sooner than they are, right? Because obviously they're not out yet. Mm-hmm. And the U1 chip motivation is very much centered around the AirTags experience. But they can't talk about AirTags yet because it's not official. And in the press briefings, they were asking about, well, what's the U1 chip for? And obviously they discussed the AirDrop, the enhanced AirDrop.
Which wasn't out yet.
Yeah. And then they also had, like, obviously a pre-prepared line, which is like, in the future, you can see how ultra wideband will be used to unlock, to act as a car key and unlock your vehicle. And like, then they'd push them for more information. They wouldn't say anything. But obviously that line was in there because the standard was clearly in development, right? Mm-hmm. And they just don't have everything tied up yet to offer it in iOS quite yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So car key, cool. And new ways to use the iPhone 11 family of phones. And you don't get UWB in the new iPad, do you?
I think it is in there, actually. They just don't advertise it anywhere.
Oh.
Because, I'm pretty sure we found code references that it is actually in there. It's just unused.
Good. I'll AirDrop to it directly now.
I'm not sure if the AirDrop UI even works on it.
Great.
But we just found, you know, like when we found that all of them have 6 gigs of RAM before they got shipped, we also saw that the U1 chip is there. It's just dormant.
Yeah. I'm not sure what we see in code for car key, but the idea from the standard itself is that its phones, watches, and tablets. And so that would be kind of neat. You don't even have a phone or a watch, and your iPad's in your backpack, and you just, you know, hop in your car and go. So.
My iPad is my key.
Yeah. Ed Sheeran does that, right? Like he has a flip phone and an iPad, no smartphone. And
I believe that is correct.
Yeah, I would know. Let's talk about a few more things before we head off for the week. So what's going on with this game streaming service App Store controversy?
Yeah, so this is something that Bloomberg kind of shined a light on this week. But it's kind of been brewing for a while. So this kind of trend at the moment of game streaming services, there's loads of them. Obviously, there's Google Stadia, there's Microsoft's xCloud, there's PlayStation Now, there's a GeForce Now, there's like a million of them. And to date, they do not offer the game streaming on the App Store for iPhone and iPad. And so this is a service where the games run in the cloud, and then they basically just stream a video feed to your device, which means they can have really high graphics fidelity, like a console level or a high-end PC, because it's streaming from the server in the cloud. It's not rendering locally on your phone. And so the video comes down, you do your controller inputs locally, the controller inputs get sent back up to the server.
Yeah, it's a good use of 5G.
And you're playing the game. That's a good use for 5G, I'll give you that. Because one of the problems at the moment is obviously the latency causes problems with game experience, especially for high-end games, which often rely on, you know, faster reflexes like first-person shooters and stuff. In general, at the moment, most people are using these services on Wi-Fi only rather than the cellular network, but definitely 5G would be something where that would actually be beneficial. However, none of these services are currently available on the App Store. They are available on Android, and they're available on like the web and stuff, but Apple's App Store rules have explicit clauses that prevent essentially any library of games from being exposed in a single application, which is very strange because they don't have this kind of rule for other media. Like they have the ebook store. You can have an ebook store on the App Store. That's fine. You can have a music service on the App Store. That's fine. Obviously Spotify's on the App Store, and you know, the Amazon Kindle ebook store is on the App Store. You can't buy through it because Amazon doesn't want to give Apple 30%, but you know, if Amazon did want to give Apple 30%, they could sell books through it as well, right? So there'd be no problem there. In theory. So the game service companies are facing issues where Apple won't let their apps in the store because of this kind of weird rule that games offered in an app must be owned or exclusively licensed by the developer, e.g. not part of a game publishing platform, and that each game must be downloaded directly from the App Store. So they have to be a separate application on the store for every single game, which is kind of insane, right? Because you don't have a separate app on the store for every single book.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, this paragraph is in the App Store review guidelines. And so that basically eliminates the business models of all of these streaming services that are offering games. Once you get, if you did get past that hurdle, then you'd have all the game streaming services complain about the 30% cut. But they can't even get to complain about the in-app purchase rules because they're currently stuck on this paragraph. Now, obviously, the contention here is that Apple Arcade exists, and Apple pushes that and promotes that to everyone on all of their billions of devices, and Apple Arcade is a game subscription service that is freely available to everyone. Now, technically, Apple Arcade does comply with every one of these rules because it's not a streaming gaming service, and each game is actually separately downloaded from the App Store. But only Apple's really in a position where they could offer that kind of service. Everyone else can't. There is one that apparently that is not a streaming service, but it's just like you get games for one subscription called Game Club, and that like brings back a load of, that's the old App Store games that they're kind of remaking,
like 32-bit games.
And so the way that app works is that you have to go to the App Store and download separate games, separate App Store apps for every single game, and then it kind of cross references the subscription across all of them. So yeah, that works, but they have a quote in this Bloomberg article that it took them 127 rejections before it was finally approved. So clearly, you know, this is a grenade-laden path as far as app review is concerned. So it is by no means easy for a company to get their game streaming service on the store. Apple basically didn't say anything apart from Apple Arcade complies with the rules, which it technically does, but, you know, it kind of feels unfair. And it seems, you know, personally, kind of ridiculous that like, I don't really understand the point of why this paragraph's here. They could, like, you can hate on the 30% and Apple taking money out of everybody, but why are they just not letting a game subscription service exist at all? It's really unclear why that rule's there. I hope they lift it, because, you know, I might actually want to play one of these game subscription services one of these days. And for the time being, they just can't exist. And there was a French one called Shadow, which I think Apple kind of missed, and it got onto the store for about a month, and now it's been pulled, presumably for the same reason.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
These stories never go away. Like you know, it's part of the App Store model, which is good.
Like, when Bloomberg posted the story, I was like, oh, this is going to be another classic battle over the 30% revenue share, right? And yes, those problems do exist, but primarily, at the moment, they can't even get the apps on the store to battle about monetization.
It's too bad.
So hopefully Apple is working with them to try and find a solution in some capacity, but for the time being, game streaming services are not coming to iOS.
Spotify should buy one of these gaming services and then
have more ammo to complain to the EU about.
Exactly. Nice. There's some news just came out that is about some of Apple's Pro app. So before now, Apple's Final Cut Pro 10 app has had a free trial offer. Now Logic Pro 10 does too. And I think the trials are extended. They're now 90-day trials. So they used to be 30-day trials for Logic Pro 10. Now it's 90 days and it includes Logic Pro, not just Final Cut Pro. So some app news there too. Which, you know, it's one of those things where you can't do the trial in the App Store, so they have to use the website for that first, and then you go to the App Store when you want to pay for it and buy it. So, fun.
Even Apple doesn't have free trials in the App Store.
Not even. All right, let's talk about iOS 13.4 now that it's actually available. This, to me, I didn't run the betas. I only installed, I think, the GM version when it was done, just to try the cursor support stuff. I tried it. I like it. It's good. I think it's very pretty, not just useful. I think from what I tried, there's still more powerful stuff with the assistive touch features, at least from what I've done so far. But I love the look of the cursor and how it changes and how apps take it over when you're over an app. And found that to be very pleasant. I even went back to my Mac and turned on magnification on the dock just a little bit more from what the dock is to try to like simulate the effect. And I was like, I don't want these labels above the dock. This is terrible. I just want it to be the icons, you know. But I think it's very pretty. My daughter, Emily, is 7, and I hooked it up for her with an old Magic Mouse 1, which is like half supported but works. You just get a warning about Bluetooth and Wi-Fi connectivity for some reason. And she's got the $329 iPad entry level with a smart keyboard case. And she uses the keyboard. She's home from school because of coronavirus, and she still has homework. And so we've been working on our lessons together with the iPad, and that's been great. She was using the Logitech Crayon as like the cursor, kind of, not just touch, but having that and like poking around the screen and dragging things around. It's more interactive, I guess. And I asked her after she had the mouse paired and knew how to use it. She was excited at first, but then the second day she didn't want to use it. And so I thought, oh, well, that's fine. And then she requested it because she was doing some reading homework, and she told me that she likes the way that the mouse gives her a line in between letters of words, and it's easier to read that way and break the words down. And she meant like the pillar, how the cursor circle becomes a pillar shape. And I saw her doing it. And I was like, that's really cool. That's a 7-year-old's review of iOS or iPadOS 13.4 and a mouse support on the iPad. And it's practical. I think it's cool.
Yeah, it's cool. And obviously, it makes the most sense when you've got some kind of case that actually has a trackpad in it, right?
Yeah. I'm looking at the Logitech case and it's not out yet. And I've contacted them directly to like, see, you know, when can I try this out? Because that's perfect. They have a version for her iPad. I think it costs $150. So it's a lot better than $350 you know, for the big iPad Magic Keyboard.
It has most of the features. It's powered by the smart connector. It's backlit. Uh-huh.
It's got function keys.
It's actually got function keys that the Magic Keyboard doesn't have.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fabric-y instead of like the, well, part of it's fabric-y at least, instead of whatever.
Yeah, and it doesn't have the cool like magnetic stand stuff, but
yeah.
The core, you know, it's a trackpad in the case is definitely there.
Yeah, I will get that for her, totally.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm pretty happy with the Trapper stuff. I released Binger Machine update this week that uses the pointer APIs to give them, you know, the nice animations and all the buttons and stuff. So I actually think the developer experience is very good as well. The other thing I tried this week, because although I was on the developer side, I was waiting for the Xcode GM to come out so then I could do the universal purchase stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about this about a month ago, where now you can have, if you have an iPhone and an iPad app, you can have a Mac app and they can be the same App Store record. So you can buy one and you can get it on across all platforms without having to rebuy. And the App Store can tie them together so it knows this is actually the Mac version of this iPhone app. And I submitted Binger Machine as a unified purchase. It was pretty smooth. Unfortunately, I had done Binger Machine on the Mac as the Catalyst app at launch, and they haven't offered a nice migration path for that, but I'd kind of predicted that, because that's why I sold Binger Machine for free on the Mac at the time. So I knew that if I did have to uproot everyone, at least I wouldn't be, you know, charging people twice. But I did have to do that. I basically had to remove the app from store. And you have to start from scratch, so I had to like type all the description out and all the keywords out again. So that was annoying.
Fine.
But it was fine. It's what's nice is when you go on the App Store on the phone and you search for Binger Machine now, it'll even say like offers Mac app in the App Store description, which it could never do before because it didn't know that this was paired to that version. There was no association there.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a slight annoyance that on the Mac, if you search the web for Binger Machine now, the kind of like the App Store preview page shows the Mac version, not the iPhone screenshots and description stuff, which I wasn't really expecting, like,
because it's primarily an iPhone app, yeah.
It's primarily an iPhone app, and that's by far the most popular. So the fact that now it kind of shows Mac screenshots, I'm a bit worried about, like, you know, maybe SEO problems and stuff. But I did test on a Windows computer, and on a Windows computer, presumably because it isn't a Mac, it does default to the iPhone screenshots, which is nice. But apart from that, I'd say it's pretty smooth sailing, and for customers, it's definitely great. It's just, even ignoring, like, some apps are going to be cheaper because you only have to buy them once now. Just the simple fact that the App Store knows that you own this app in three places lets them show the little, you know, little details like, oh, this Mac app's also available, and it enables like automatic download and it shows up in your purchase history. It just all works much better, and they should have done this years ago. And it's, yes, it's annoying that they didn't offer a migration strategy for existing apps. But
the Mac App Store turns 10 next year, and I was looking back at the purchases, like the first things I downloaded and everything, and like if any of them are still useful or even in the App Store. And you know, I also thought about in 2011 working at the Apple Store, people would open the Mac App Store and look for like Microsoft Office, you know, and it's there now. But they thought that it's the App Store. So where are all of the apps from the iPhone? And even with like making a specific app for the iPhone, there was no way to connect the bridge there. And this is that. Like, this is what's people have not just wanted, but needed for discovery's sake since then. So we're finally there, thanks to, I guess, Catalyst.
Yep, and also this week I got to try iCloud folder sharing for the first time.
Yeah!
I was running the iOS beta, but I never run the Mac beta, so I upgraded the Mac. Perfectly fine update situation. And I made a shared folder. I shared it with you. I put a text file in it. You edited the text file. I saw the changes. The world didn't explode any more than it already is. And it seemed to work well.
That's the most complicated, like, horsepower intensive test we could do. So if a text file works, then anything will work. We can put logic files in there and, you know, nothing will break.
Look, it's baby steps, right? I do want to, assuming the reliability is there, I'll happily switch over to it. But there's been enough problems with iCloud stuff, especially new stuff, and this one got pulled from the beta and then restored, that, you know, I'm approaching it a little tentatively. I'm not like I'm never going to use it, right? The whole point is I've now made this folder and I'm basically just going to run it concurrently with our Dropbox happy hour folder for a few weeks or whatever, and assuming there's no problems, I'll happily switch to it, because, you know, I'm kind of fed up with Dropbox, and unlike, like, you know, I'm not like in an enterprise where they use the more complicated Dropbox feature. I literally just need a folder that syncs files on a weekly basis, and that's about it.
So. Yeah, and we rely on iCloud notes folder sharing for that, and it's wonderful. So I'm glad this is here too. And then finally, there's some music changes with the new updates, right?
Yeah, so in 10.15.4, you get the live lyrics on the Mac now, which is nice, and it has a cool full screen experience. It is a bit laggy and not as nice as the iOS and tvOS versions, unfortunately, but you know, that's iTunes for you. Still iTunes under the covers. They on the Apple Music service, they also have a new GitHub mix that they've added this week, which joins the other like algorithmic things they make on a weekly basis for you, which is like the new music mix and the discovery mix and the other one that I can't remember the name of, the friends mix.
Get chill, friends, new music, chill, favorites. Yeah. Now,
and
get
so
up.
Now they got one which is GitHub, which is meant to be like, you know, upbeat songs to kind of get you up in the morning or whatever.
Or to lift your spirits.
To lift your spirits. I know you said that it seemed very samey to your existing playlist, right?
To my favorites mix, which I think just speaks to the kind of things I play more, you know, upbeat anyway.
You're just an upbeat guy.
But favorites is only what you've listened to in your library, and Get Up is also more stuff because I had like some share in there that it's not my library. So it was like 95% my music plus, you know, a couple of recommendations.
Yeah, mine was more diverse than stuff in my library, and pretty good music. I was pretty happy with it. So, you know, it's a nice thing to have on the lineup on the thing, because the more of that kind of stuff they can do, the better. And finally, at least on iOS now, you can sign up to get new music notifications inside of the app. So for a while, they've had this thing where you'd get like a push notification when one of the artists that it thinks that you really like, so you listen to their music and you've already added music by them, it will give you a push notification on the lock screen that will tell you that there's a new album coming out or there's new songs and new music. And now they're integrating that directly into the library view. There's a setting for this, so if you don't want this, you can turn it off. But I think it's pretty nice. And it just puts a nice little banner at the top of the library screen of, oh, there's a new album out by this artist that you, you know, hopefully really enjoy and you listen to a lot of their stuff, because it is algorithmic at the end of the day. And then there's like a one button tap you can do to add it to your library permanently, or you can just tap and play the songs. Mm-hmm. So I still wish there was even like a more explicit way, because the fact that it relies on the Apple Music algorithm just knowing that you really like this band or this singer does give that kind of like, you know, you can't 100% trust it, because sometimes it's going to get it wrong. I do wish there was just like a button where it's like, just tell me whenever this artist releases a new album or a new single, right? Like,
yeah.
Just make it very direct and then have the algorithm thing there as a fallback. But at least, you know, it steps forward, and I'd love to see him do more of that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep, cool. And then finally, there's iPad Pro reviews that have been released. And so, you know, it's funny because iPad Pro reviews, they sort of have to focus on the year-over-year changes, or in this case, the year-and-a-half changes. And so it's how does it compare to the 2018 iPad Pro 11 and 12.9-inch? And in that case, it's very small. It's like a half step to an upgrade. But compared to like your iPad Pro, I think it's pretty compelling. If you liked the 2018 iPad Pro, you know, and we're just waiting for something different, you might get a better deal on storage. For the base model at least, you know, it's cool. I'm more curious this week than last week about it, but just because of the LiDAR stuff, having seen some demonstrations of apps and development that use it. You know, I think like AR in general is just vague and it's hard to be interested in it. But if you can find something that you're interested in that uses it, like I'm testing a couple of beta, rocket launch tracking apps that notify you of upcoming launches and have different features. And one of the features in one of the apps is ARKit, where you can see the specific rocket that's launching in AR. And right now you've got to find the flat surface and put it on there, you know? So, I'm because I found a niche within the niche, I'm interested now a little bit. And so I only will go to this if I can sell the iPad I have now for the cost of the new one. But I'm not certain yet. It's just that has to be the opportunity. But other than that, I mean, the camera stuff, take it or leave it. The microphone upgrades are going to be minimal, I believe. And the chip is like totally
identical.
CPU, it's the same GPU. They've activated a disabled core. I mean, there's even a new document out tonight that someone looked at the chip closer, and it's literally, you know, the 812X, but with that core activated, and that's all there is. So yeah, it's you know, same thing we said last week.
It's a small update, because we did have like such a big update with the 2018 iPad Pro.
Yeah, and, it was huge.
You know, like the iPad Pro update is along the same, it's probably within the same lines as like the MacBook Air update, right? It's just like the MacBook Air got a couple of, you know, spec bumps and the price went down. And this basically kept the same price and added a couple more features on the end. And fingers crossed, at some point there will be, you know, a compelling use for the LiDAR scanner at some point.
Yeah.
Just not today, really.
Yeah. And at first I would think that it's more useful on the iPhone because it's with you and you can do it in more places. But, you know, it's not just LiDAR. It's the screen that you're using. And so having a big screen like the iPad is also half of the equation. So I'm like if the camera upgrade, like if, you know, you get a better camera on the iPad than you have on the iPhone, then that's weird to me because you're going to take more pictures with your phone. But I think that having it first on the LiDAR first on the iPad is, you know, makes some sense to me now after thinking more about it. And then finally, I want to give you an update on my HomePod status because I don't know how many HomePods I had at peak HomePod season, but it's like eight, six. Yeah, maybe that you knew about. I'm not down to two. I had three before for a long time, and now I'm down to two. I just have a stereo pair in the living room, and that's it.
So why did you get rid of the other one?
I was visiting some family in Florida, not my aunt and uncle, but my wife's grandparents. And the last time I was there, they purchased a HomePod as an accessibility tool to sort of get around the difficulty of operating the iPhone without vision. And the HomePod did that for them. If the phone rings, they can answer it on the HomePod. They can make phone calls on the HomePod, send and receive messages that way. And then all the stuff you can do, like music and podcasts and everything. But they only purchased the one HomePod on their own, and they had a good experience with it. But it's in their bedroom, and they spend, you know, like anyone, half the time in the bedroom or, you know, 8 hours in the bedroom and then some time there, but then most of the time in the living room. And so I saw that the next time I visited them and asked how it was going, you know, and they kind of thought they could put it in the middle of their house and have it cover everything. But, you know, it can do that in some layouts. But for them, it was bedroom here and then living room, and that covers everything. So as I was going out of town, it was like the last minute impulse thought, but I was like, bedroom HomePod for me. I use it every day, but it's not, I don't think it's as much value as for me as it is for them, especially with having the living room one. And so I just brought it and I set it up and they were very happy. And down to two. And, you know, it was one of those things where I get to see it be used and that's all the reward that I need. And, you know, HomePod hasn't changed in a big way in a while. So it's expanding would be to have a much cheaper model for me. It would be nice. And I do have AirPlay 2 speakers throughout the house. So not just HomePod, but like Sonos speakers that work with AirPlay 2 and others. So I can do full home audio, but most of what I do is just play on the one. And in this case, the stereo pair. So that's it. And it's getting good use now. So, and you know, it's, I'm happy to see that. So it's cool.
Nice.
Yep, cool. I didn't buy a new one, is what I'm saying.
I was worried when I saw Zach Campbell update in the show notes.
Yeah, even it's one of those things where whenever they did the price drop and then retailers had even lower prices, we just bought the new house in October and that was happening a lot for the holidays. And so impulsively, I would have wanted to have bought, like snatched up a good deal because I would want more HomePods for, you know, as many rooms as possible. But I looked at the list of like home improvements that you want to make and what that costs too. And it was like HomePod, you know, even $200 is not a priority. So
yeah. Like, I do really like the HomePod, but I can't blame anyone for not buying it because it still feels a tad too expensive and they don't quite give it all the love that it needs yet.
Yeah, which some stuff is kind of rumored, maybe. At least, you know, it's...
Yeah, we got the rumors about like native Spotify, which then also maybe means native apps support. And
so but you don't need more than a stereo.
There are rumors of the hardware, you know, of a HomePod Mini coming sometime. So
yeah,
that would definitely help the lineup.
HomePod Mini comes out, I'll totally get one of those. And then like you every week, I'll put one in the office and I'll have to tell it to not listen for the Hey and Siri. And so that we can do a podcast about Apple and then remember to turn it back on when the show's over.
It's a hard life.
Yeah, it's tough. It's funny. My wife was like, where's the HomePod? And I was like, I gave it to your grandparents. You know, they can use it more than us. And she was like, yeah, but I turned the fan on with that. Like, okay. So that was a good family test, I guess. But All right. That is the Happy Hour podcast for the week. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at ApolloZach. And I also write space news and history at spaceexplored.com. Benjamin, you're on Twitter and you blog where?
At BZAMayo and BZAMayo.com.
Nice. And we
will and 95 Mac, obviously.
That's true. Yeah, more than me. And we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.